Okay, there's a little thing here for Colleen if she wants to pick it up. Before we get going, we usually introduce guests in the class before we get started. So if there are any guests here in the class, if you haven't been here in a while or this is your first time, anyone? Right here. And what's your name and where are you from?
My name is
from Alhambra. And so who invited you to the class? This gentleman right there. Well, thank you for bringing her along. Okay. Anyone else here? Yes, over here.
John.
And you're from? West Covina. Okay. And who brought you to the class? Or you just decided to come on your own? Or? Okay. Well, very good. All right. Well, glad to have you here with us. Okay, this is a class where we interact and ask questions. Last time we got together, I did most of the talking. This time I'm going to make you do some of the work, okay? So we'll be doing that as we get into Job chapter 38. What we're doing here is going through the different creation accounts in the Bible. There are 20 major creation accounts in the Bible, so we're currently going through Job 34 to 41. Maybe a little piece of 42 we'll include as well. Well, what we try to do in every class is give a field report and then a report on some new scientific discovery that's giving additional weight of evidence for the Christian faith. I got a couple of discoveries I want to talk about, so I'm going to really shorten the field report just to simply let you know that there was a conference at UCLA, and it's organized by one of the leading atheist biologists out there. And this is a conference he's put up together on the Cameron explosion. And a couple of our volunteers that had reasons to believe are on the faculty at UCLA. And so they attended this conference, and they said it was just phenomenal in terms of the new evidences that you can glean there that are putting the evolutionary model in trouble and really giving stronger evidence for the Christian faith. Jeff Wierink in particular gave us a report on that yesterday. There's a couple of discoveries I really want to focus on, so occasionally I'll do that with you. I'll shorten up the field report in order to squeeze in an extra scientific discovery, and then we'll jump into the book of Job. And these are both published in Nature, the latest issue of Nature. And one deals with a phenomenon we're all familiar with here in California. Where do the world's tallest trees reside? They reside in Northern California, Humboldt County. And the tallest tree in the world lives up there. It's 370 feet tall. Well, what happened is a bunch of California biologists decided to go up there to Humboldt County, and they actually climbed these tall trees. They got permission to climb the tallest tree in the world and a few other of the trees that are almost as tall. And they looked at things like the leaf structure as you go up. And what they were able to confirm is that indeed as you rise to the very tops of these trees, the photosynthetic efficiency drops to almost zero. And there's a reason for that, is that you're butting up against the laws of physics. Because, you know, how does water get up to those leaves that are 370 feet off the ground? Well, it's the pull from transpiration that does it. I mean, you've got water evaporating at the top, and so that's what pulls the water up those 370 feet. But, you know, gravity is pretty tough, so there's a limit to how far up the xylem of the tree you can pull this water. And what they've observed is that the leaves, the very tops of these tallest trees, are designed so that they can have the greatest possible pull on the water, but in order to get the greatest possible pull, they sacrifice photosynthetic efficiency. And so the photosynthetic efficiency is really, really low. And you would say, well, how can you explain this from a naturalistic or a Darwinian perspective? It'd be really difficult to explain from a naturalistic or Darwinian perspective because, you know, naturalism or Darwinism would reward efficiency. What we see here is extremely low efficiency. Yeah, we got a question here? Bingo, you got it. That's exactly what they discovered. And they, for the first time, they measured the efficiency with which these redwoods can absorb water directly from the fog. And they were startled to discover it added up to 35% of the total rain and snow precipitation in that area. I mean, Humboldt County gets, what, about 30 to 35 inches of rain a year. and yet the forest you see up there look like a place that you would expect from some place getting 60 or 70 inches of rain a year. So you get this lush forest thanks to the fact that you've got these trees, and the degree to which the forest can absorb moisture from the fog is directly dependent on the height of the tallest trees. Because basically these tall trees act as a barrier to the fog. And if it wasn't for those tall trees, the fog would roll over, roll back, and there wouldn't be much benefit to the trees or the plants at the bottom of the forest floor. But because of the extreme height of these trees, they're able to pick up a lot of moisture from this incoming fog. And this is something they also noted in their research paper, that places in the world where you've got consistent coastal fog rolling in over the land masses, that's where you have these tall trees. And, you know, we have redwoods here. Other parts of the world have other trees that gain a considerable height. But there is this limit, about 370, 380 feet, beyond which the laws of physics won't allow a tree to get any taller than that. Another factor they dealt with here is called the brittleness, is that this really only works in places where you don't get very strong winds. Otherwise, you know, something that tall will break, and you won't be able to achieve that kind of height. But again, that kind of fits Humboldt County. Yes. Well, I mean, basically it's transpiration. The fact that, you know, you got these leaves and water is being evaporated, and the evaporation of the water acts as a pull that pulls the water up the xylem. There's also capillary motion going on. So, you know, these are very thin tubes running up the tree, and so you get a capillary pull, but in addition to that, there's a pull from the transpiration. But if you add the two together, there's a limit to how much you can get that, because, you know, the growth of those leaves will be dependent on how much water they're able to pick up. That's exactly it. It's an electro process. You get a charge there, and that pulls on it too. Yeah, and it's basically an energy trade-off. So, you know, what the leaves do is they trade photosynthetic efficiency for a greater capacity to pull the water in. Well, it's more complex than that. There are several factors that play into, you know, how much water you can get up to a certain height. And this is the first place I've seen. It's basically a cooperative effort between physicists and biologists saying, you know, no one has ever really defined what the laws of physics impose as a limit to tree height. And so they said, you know, this is worth doing. Let's do it. And they were able to theoretically calculate that the laws of physics would limit the height of trees. I mean, if physics was the only limit rather than biology, the highest you could go would be about 380 to 385 feet. Then they said, well, let's see what the tallest trees are actually coming in at. 370 feet. However, there are historical records of redwoods hitting 383 feet, I think, is the highest. So the tallest living tree today is 370 feet, but there are historical records that put it right up to the very limit that the laws of physics would permit. And so the question these biologists asked is, you know, what's going on here? Because we wouldn't expect, under Darwinian principles, that you would get something hitting the very limit. It should stop quite a bit short because of the enormous inefficiencies involved. So that's basically the sense of the paper. They really didn't. I mean, it's a short paper. It's two pages long, the paper. And they made note of the fact that physicists had made efforts in the past to establish this limit, did not take into account all the factors. They said, we've done that, and we've been able to come up with a limit that's actually a little bit higher than what physicists had previously established. By a little bit, they added 2 meters, 6 feet. So, you know, previously we thought the limit was a little bit lower. They said, no, we pushed up a little bit higher. But they also made note of the fact that historical records do establish, not just for redwoods, but for other species of trees, that you actually do have living trees that hit a height of 380 to 383 feet, which is right bang up against the limit. And so, but from a creation model perspective, you know, a god that wants to have as many lush forests on the planet as possible, this would make sense. And, you know, the bottom line here is what we see in the fossil record is that for the past 400 million years, planet Earth has had tall trees in these places where the fog would allow for the capture of water to make for a more lush environment. And how do we human beings benefit? Well, it's these lush forests that really give us a good portion of the biodeposits that we're now reaping. So things like coal, oil, natural gas, you know, the limestones, we can be grateful for the fact that there's been these forests that have made all that possible, particularly the coal. Coal is quite dependent on having abundant lush forests. So the fact that we've had the benefit of this for 400 million years, and not just over one or two places on the planet, but a large number of places on the planet, means we have those resources to reap. And of course, those of us here in the room, a few of us probably have some redwood in our homes or backyards. And so even now, we're reaping the benefits of God designing these trees in such a way that they can capture water that plants normally would not capture. And it's not just the redwoods that benefit. Because of these redwoods, they get extra water, but all the rest of the plants in the forest canopy there also gain extra water. So everybody benefits from capturing this water that otherwise would simply be unexploited. And so reasonably dry parts of the world, like Northern California, are able to manifest a bioculture that you would typically only expect to see in a rainforest. Yes. Well, okay. In terms of pure competition, the trees that would win were those that would have high photosynthetic efficiency. These trees have the lowest photosynthetic efficiency that biologists can measure, and yet they're there. And therefore, you know, that would fit the mold of a creator saying, you know, I'm going to make these trees, even though they're extremely inefficient at a photosynthetic level, because these are the trees that are going to be able to capture the water and fog that will benefit not just the redwoods, but all the rest of the plant life that is in that region. And so it would fit a creation model in the context that if you've got a creator who wants to maximally benefit a future human species, starting about 400 million years ago, he would create these species of tall trees, because over 400 million years, those tall trees would generate a much larger biodeposit mass than if you didn't have the trees at all. So we wind up with extra fossil fuels as a result of the creator's hand over the past 400 million years, and we're benefiting today. I mean, where else can you go and get a nice piece of timber that's 100 feet long without knots in it? So, you know, redwoods make that possible for us. Never mind the rest of the resources that we get in Humboldt County and elsewhere. And hey, you look at the entire Pacific coast from Northern California all the way up to Alaska, you see this principle in operation. That whole coastline has these heavy fogs that roll in, and you got the redwoods in California, you got the Douglas fir in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia, then the Sitka spruce grows up in northern British Columbia, Alaska, and Yukon. And, you know, those are all high-quality timbers that we use for our construction, but over the course of the past 400 million years, that puts coal deposits, rich coal deposits, in many more places of the planet than you would otherwise get without those tall trees. Okay? Let me give you the next one. We've gone from the very big to the small. There's an article in here about shrimp. Okay? And for the first time, biologists have done a study on the mechanical components that make up the peacock mantis shrimp. And what they found is this shrimp has a spring mechanism and a ratchet mechanism. You know, as I read the article, the thing that comes to mind that's probably the closest analogy to this would be a crossbow. You know how a crossbow works? You've got this piece of steel or, you know, some kind of fiberglass, and that's the bow, and you bend it back with a ratchet mechanism. You basically turn this handle, and what it does is it pulls the string back over ratchet so that you put increasingly greater and greater tension on the bow. And, you know, a really good crossbow, you can put 600 pounds, foot-pounds of force on that bow. And how do you do it? Because, you know, no one's that strong. But if you use your muscle over a long period of time, ratcheting it a bit at a time, quick, 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 then over the course of, say, 5 minutes, you can build up this enormous tension in the bow of the crossbow, and then you wait for some poor suspecting animal to come by, and you pull a trigger, and this thing goes, this little arrow goes zooming out, and effectively takes care of the prey that you're hunting. Well, this they found this little tiny shrimp that has a similar mechanism. It's got this powerful spring, and it's a paraboloid spring, which is a kind of spring that would generate the maximum storage of energy. And then the shrimp has this device whereby it's able to use a quick ratchet that increasingly puts more and more tension on this little spring that it has as part of its body. And so it does the same thing that a good crossbow hunter does. It uses its muscles to gradually ratchet up more and more storage of energy in this hammer. It's kind of like a hammer mechanism. You've got this thing like this, and you've got the spring controlling the hammer, and the thing ratchets it up like this, puts increasing tension on the spring, and then when the shrimp comes along and sees this nice mollusk, and what its favorite prey are mollusks with these very thick, hard shells. And I know you've ever been to the beach, and I'm trying to think of the name. Maybe a biologist here can help me. Maybe Richard can help me here. There's these little shells that exist at the beach that you find here in California, and they have these very thick, hard shells. And I remember my kids picking these things up and hitting them with a hammer. They don't break. They have very strong shells. This is the prey that the shrimp goes after. No, it's this, pardon me? Could be. It's something that it's kind of like a cylinder with a high shell on it, and it's got a little opening at the bottom. You find them in the tropics. You find them a little bit on the beach here. Not conch shells. They're about this big. Huh? Whelks? Yeah, it could be. Yeah. Anyway, boys had fun trying to crack them open, but without much success. But this little tiny shrimp is able to get it open. And how it does it, it's got this little hammer device and has this spring, ratchets up all its energy, and when it pulls the trigger, the energy release is greater than 9,000 G's. So, as these biologists describe, this is the most powerful striking mechanism known in the entire animal kingdom. There's no other animal that can hit you with a blow as strong as this little tiny shrimp. So you might say, you know, who can deliver the strongest punch in the animal kingdom? It's this little tiny shrimp. It can deliver a blow that's more than 9,000 G's. And you say, and you keep in mind this is happening underwater. So you've got all this, you know, it's not like delivering a hammer in the air. You've got all this water resisting the flow of the hammer. But how the hammer works, it's not the blow of the hammer on the shell that puts a hole in the shell. This hammer runs through the water at such a high rate, it creates bubbles. And the bubbles smash into the shell, and it's the bubbles themselves that crack open the shell. It's called cavitation. You know, when I was a fourth-year physics student, I had to take a class on cavitation physics. And that's what it's all about, is studying bubbles and how if you can move these bubbles at extremely high velocity, they can do extreme damage. And you know how it fits in practically as a propeller design. You got to watch how you design propellers because if you create bubbles and they're moving at a high velocity, they can damage your propeller. But this is a shrimp that knocks holes in shells by creating these bubbles moving at very high velocity. It's called the peacock mantis shrimp. Okay? Where are they located? The article doesn't say. Maybe someone here knows. But how big are they? They're on the small side as shrimp go. So these are not prawns. These are tiny little creatures. That's the question you had. Okay. Pardon me? I don't know. That could be interesting. In other words, is our Defense Department interested in exploiting this shrimp design? I'm wondering, does the Defense Department have any hammers that deliver 9,000 Gs? I probably doubt it. So, We need recruits, okay. But it's the first time they've ever found one of these parabolic springs in an animal, and it's the first time they found anything that delivers anywhere close. What they said is the force of the hammer is about two orders of magnitude greater than what they find in any other animal species. So, but you know, where I think this fits in terms of bolstering our creation model, you know, this is a complicated design. Again, how would you anticipate that naturalistic evolution would possibly evolve in one species only, a device of this complexity delivering that kind of power? You know, I would expect from an evolutionary perspective that, you know, just leave these little mollusks alone. And, you know, they got these big hard shells, so what? But isn't it interesting that in terms of the animal kingdom is that every creature has a predator. I mean, they really don't see any herbivores out there that don't have a prey that feeds on them. And this is something we're going to see in Job 38, is how God has set up the animal kingdom in such a way that everything is in balance. And the herbivores do need predators. So these little poor mollusks that have these extremely thick shells, they're not going to do as well if the shrimp aren't around. The shrimp really do play a role in making sure that this species of mollusk is in the healthiest possible state. So even though they got these enormously thick, very hard shells, what does God do? He designs a predator that's able to feed on these mollusks and not feed too efficiently that they wipe them out, but not feed so inefficiently that it doesn't improve the health and the population of this mollusk species. It's something we're going to be looking at in Job 38. Predators are good, and that God shows his love by creating predators and making sure that he provides just the right kind of prey for these predators, and making sure the prey get the just right kind of predators to increase their health. Yes. One of the most efficient... Well, you might want to do that. Yeah, there is. Owls. Owls are very effective at feeding on skunks. We have skunks in our neighborhood, but we also have owls. So they enjoy the skunks. Our cat does, too. Our cat has made friends with a skunk. So, and consequently, our cat got attacked by two owls, but was able to fend them off. So, but, yeah, owls don't seem to be bothered by the smell of skunks at all. You know, they'll pick up a skunk, and it's spraying all over the place, and the owl just carts it off. So... Yeah. Okay, the 9,000 G's refers to the maximum acceleration of the stroke of the hammer. And so it's just before it makes impact. And see, it's not the impact of the hammer that does the damage. It's the motion of the hammer through the water that creates this stream of bubbles that hits the target that does the damage. Okay. It's after the thing is released. And so it's you get the release, and this hammer's moving through the water, and it's in that phase. So it's not at the strike point. It's quite a bit before the strike point, because after all, the design is to take advantage of the bubbles. Yeah, I mean, that's another part of the design, is that this creature is designed in such a way that it achieves maximum acceleration of the hammer at the ideal time in the stroke of the hammer to achieve the purpose that the shrimp would have for feeding on these prey. By the way, it doesn't always work. The shrimp has got to be really careful in lining up the hammer on the particular mollusk. You know, these mollusks are designed with a particular shape. It's kind of like, you know, when you're shooting at tanks. If you hit the tank at the wrong angle, then the blow glances off. You've got to hit it just right. And so not every strike of the mantis has success. The shrimp has got to be patient to make sure that he lines up the blow just right. And if the little mollusk moves off target or a wave comes in, then they don't get a kill. Okay, all the paper says is that the peak acceleration is achieved just after the trigger is released. Yeah. Closer to the beginning than the end. Okay, yeah. Okay, you're moving. I mean, you can do this experiment at home. Take a knife from your drawer, fill up a little kettle of water, and put the knife in there, and then move it really fast. Okay, you're moving all this water out, and you create a little vacuum behind the water. There is air in the water. There's dissolved air in the water. Yeah. So it does work, but you only generate the bubbles if you move the hammer really fast. And my guess is that you're probably not going to be able. I mean, a knife in a kettle of water, you might not be able to pull it off. The whole point is, it's really hard to move a knife through water, to move anything through water, fast enough to generate the bubbles. Okay, I mean, maybe the best example is, think of one of your kids diving into the high end of the pool. Okay, they dive in, and there'll be a stream of bubbles. So, yeah, it's air they're dragging in, but, so, yeah. But you got to move it fast to get the bubbles. So, in fact, when I was a fourth-year physics student, one of the problem assignments we had was how fast you have to move a hammer to get bubbles. Then how fast you have to move the hammer before the bubbles do any damage. Or the propeller problem. You know, how fast does the propeller have to revolve before you start damaging the propeller from the bubbles that it causes. So that's why there's a limit to how fast you can move ships with a propeller. So, okay, any more comments before we move into the Book of Job? Yes. That's all true. And you know what amazed the biologists is that when these bubbles made contact, they could actually hear an explosive sound. It hit with such force, it was like a firecracker going off. And they could measure the amount of heat release, the sound release. So, you can do a lot of damage with bubbles. Okay, anyone else? Okay, let's move into Job 38. Now, just to set the context here, because in Job 37, we have Elihu speaking, and in Job 38, the Lord speaks. Now, the Lord hasn't said anything since Job chapters 1 and 2. So he's listening to this conversation. Let me just kind of set the stage here. The book of Job opens up with God and Satan having a conversation about God's servant Job. And I think most of you know the story. Job says he's not as righteous as you claim he is. Now let me do an experiment and I'll prove it to you. And God says, okay, you can do the experiment, but there's going to be limits on the experiment. You cannot kill Job, but you can bring great grief upon him. And the chapter 3 tells you about all the grief that Satan brings upon Job. You mean he loses his family. He retains his wife. That's about the only thing that survives all the damage. He loses his wealth. He loses all of his children. His home is knocked down. And so he has suffered this catastrophic loss. And to top it all off, Satan says, well, God told me I couldn't kill you, but boy, I'm going to really make your life miserable from the physical context. And so he had all these boils over his body, and it was so bad he was scraping the pus out. I won't get into all the details. But he really did suffer. Okay. Then along comes three of his best friends and say, Job, we're really sorry that you're going through all of this. And, you know, as the text points out, they remain silent for many days. It isn't until more than a week passes by that they decide to speak. And, you know, that period of silence was to show Job that they really did care for all the suffering and the calamities that he experienced. But finally they decide it's time to really encourage Job with our words. And what they say is, Job, the reason this is happening to you is that there's sin in your life. And, you know, everybody thinks you're such a righteous guy, but clearly you're not. And, you know, you really need to repent of all the evil that you've been doing secretly. We haven't seen it, but you must have been doing some secret evil. You need to repent of that, and then all this bad stuff will go away. And Job protests and said, that's not what's going on. That's not how God operates. Let me teach you how God operates. And what's interesting, when Job speaks, from chapter 7 through to chapter 19, he builds this case for how God works with humanity, how God saves humanity from their sins, by appealing to the evidence that God has revealed in the record of nature. So he basically says to his three friends, look around you and look at the plants, the animals, the stars, you know, the earth and how it's structured. And this will tell you things about God. And he basically builds the following case. He says, as we look out at the natural realm, clearly there must be a God. And the three friends agree with him. Yeah, we all agree that there's got to be a God to explain the complexity, the harmony, the beauty of the natural realm. And then Job makes a few more points. He says, you know, this God not only exists, this God must be exceptionally wise, because look at how well it's all put together. And, you know, here the four of us are sitting, and we can't figure it out. It's just way too marvelous. And therefore, this God must be a lot smarter and more knowledgeable than we human beings. God is very wise and very knowledgeable. And then he says that God must be very powerful to be able to pull all this together. And then he says God must be loving. Look at the way he's provided for us and provided for all of his creatures. He's provided for the parasites, he's provided for the herbivores, he's provided for the carnivores, and it's all done in such a way that everybody benefits. He says this is clearly a mark of a God who is very loving. But then he says we human beings look within and we're plagued with this law that God has written on our hearts. And Job makes the point that every man, every woman has the same law, the same code of morality written on their hearts, the conscience. And he says this proves that God is just. Then the 19th chapter, he kind of pulls it all together for his three friends. He said, you know, we human beings have this law written on our hearts, and we all know we don't measure up. When you accuse me of evil, you're right. I am evil. Everybody is evil. We all fall short of God's moral standard, because the standard is one of perfection. And God doesn't grade on a curve. He says we know God doesn't grade on a curve because our conscience reacts even when we're doing better than our fellow man. So simply getting in the top 5% doesn't deal with the problem that we fall short of God's standard. In fact, the way the conscience operates, as many of us know, as you get into that top 5 or 10%, the conscience screams more loudly than it does when you're in the bottom 5 or 10%, morally speaking. And that's the way it is with all of us. The more you try to live up to God's moral standard, the louder the conscience screams at you that you're falling short. And, you know, basically Job says, I'm in that category. My conscience is screaming at me that I'm falling short, just like it is with you. And they basically commend one another by the fact that they're doing pretty well in terms of the morality. And they probably were. So they were in that upper category. Nevertheless, they were plagued with his conscience. And then Job makes the following point. None of us as human beings can possibly satisfy the justice of God. The only way we can satisfy God's justice is if God intervenes. And he says there must therefore be a redeemer. And he says, I'm convinced there must be a redeemer because God is too smart not to figure a way out of the problem that we all face. And God is too caring not to want to deliver us. So he says God, as a God of love, would want to deliver us from our hopeless moral dilemma. And God is smart enough to figure a way out, and he's powerful enough to pull it off. Therefore, in the 19th chapter, Job says, I know that my Redeemer lives, and I will see him on the last day. In my flesh I will see him. So he says, you know, the resurrection that I will experience as I put my trust and faith in God will not just be spiritual, it'll be a physical one. So it's amazing that he was able to discern this without any Bible, without any prophet, without any evangelist. He figured this out by looking at the record of nature. Now, sometimes this is used by certain denominations in Christendom, an argument for, you know, therefore, why do we need preachers? Why do we need evangelists? Why do we need missionaries? And, you know, Job actually addresses that and says, well, not many have the humility that's necessary to be able to submit your life to the Creator simply on the evidence you see in the natural realm. And I think that's true today. We've had more evidence from the natural realm than any other generation. But does that mean that we have many more people submitting themselves to Christ's plan for salvation as Job did? I don't think so. And I think really the answer there is, unlike the days of Job, people today are dealing with a lot more pride than people at that time. More of us lack the humility of Job today than people living 4,000 years ago. So all this extra evidence, in one sense, is to break through the additional pride that we human beings are manifest. And that really kind of takes over the theme as you move from chapter 20 and following. Because basically what happens is the three philosopher friends of Job begin to wear him down. And they begin to marshal their arguments. And they claim, you know, well, this gospel that you've laid out, that's really not the way God works. Now, I think there's a warning in here that when we get into spiritual battles with people that are rebelling against God's plan of salvation, it can wear you down. So here's Job. It's 3-1, and they go on for quite a few chapters. But who comes to the rescue? This one guy that hasn't said a word for, 32 chapters. Elihu, a young man, is sitting there with the four older men. And days have gone by. And I imagine this debate has gone by for at least a week, if not a month. Because after all, it reaches a point where the text says that the three friends of Job have said everything they can possibly say. And I've been with philosophers. It takes a long time before they run out of words. And these three men had run out of words. And then this young man, Elihu, jumps in and says, okay, you've all had your piece. Job has said everything he wants to say. You three gentlemen have said everything you want to say. I'm the youngest here. I've kept quiet the whole time. And that's kind of an amazing testimony. Can you imagine being a young man listening to these four elder statesmen spout off for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, maybe a month or two, and just staying completely quiet the whole time? I mean, I look at my sons. I can't imagine they would remain quiet for 3 minutes, let alone 3 weeks. But this is the discipline of Elihu. He carefully listens. That's how he starts off in the 32nd chapter. He says, I've carefully weighed all your words, but I find fault with your words. And when he says he finds fault with Job, what he's referring to, he says, I find fault with your responses to these three gentlemen over the last part of the debate. He does not pick a fight with what Job said in Job 7-19. But he says, I find fault with you, Job, and what you've said in chapters 21 up to 31. So there I find fault. And basically what he does when he starts to speak is he reiterates Job's original argument. He says, Job, what you said here is right, and let me give you additional evidence for why your presentation of how God saves us from our sins is the correct interpretation. And so he comes in to Job's rescue and says, this is really the way it is. You're right. These three guys are wrong, and you are wrong in the way you rebutted these three people. Yes.
Very high
argument. True. Yeah, that definitely was a factor that was going on. Nevertheless, I think Elihu showed enormous patience, because my interpretation of the text is this is not a short conversation. It must have gone on for many days, probably many weeks. And Elihu patiently kept his tongue throughout that whole time. So, but then he comes in and he says his piece. Now, it's interesting in the chapters of Elihu we've been studying these past several months is that Elihu is not only giving a response to Job and his three friends, he's laying out something underneath the veneer. Yes.
So, if you like Job, it's
not the same. True, but many commentators... Yes, but many commentators also say this is Job expressing to his three friends the degree of suffering he's going through. No, I'm willing to concede that. That what I'm simply pointing out is that Job's response, although it has some literal context, also has some metaphorical context. That's all true. Right, right. Yeah, I'm just saying, pay attention to the fact that that's chapter has a lot of emotional content in it. Right. I mean, he is expressing the suffering that he's going through and what happens. And I mean, I think there's been some of us here in this room where you've had episodes where the pain in your life is so great that you'll do almost anything to get rid of the pain. And, Job was certainly in that context. Okay, but now we're moving into Job 38, and the Lord speaks. But the reason why I've spent some time kind of giving a preamble to this is that when the Lord speaks, it's going to be somewhat like what Elihu is doing. Elihu is basically responding to the debate that has been going on, but at the same time, he's laying out some creation theology. And we've spent some time picking up that creation theology that he lays out. And I'd like to suggest this also happens with Job 38 and following. And many commentators make this point that Job is responding to the five men. Elihu, Job, and Job's three friends. But I'd like to suggest, in addition to that, he's laying out more creation theology. Elihu has let out some. And then now the Lord speaks, and he gives some more. And what I suggested last week was this, that surely the Lord in chapter 38 is responding to the bad philosophy and bad logic and theology of the five men. He makes that point. He also speaks directly to us. And he's basically saying, okay, these five men are not as smart as they think they are. But that also is a message to all of us. We're not as smart as we think we are.
Or holy.
I mean, he basically says, okay, you've laid out some good creation theology, but there's a lot more going on. And I think that's a particular message for today. There are Christians today who believe that they really have the creation theology of the Bible case. We know what it says, and you know they're out there proclaiming that. And basically, as the Lord speaks here, he says, no human being has it all put together. Now, you've got pieces of it, but you don't have it all put together, and therefore, you need to really be somewhat cautious and humble in trying to discern my motives in creating. And so he certainly upbraids the five men for attributing to God motives that really betrays their lack of understanding of what's going on in the created realm. But the suggestion I made last week was that underlying all of this is God declaring in his response to these five men insights that reflect on Genesis chapter 1. And that's true of virtually every one of the creation accounts in the Bible, is that we open up the Bible with Genesis chapter 1, and you know, God takes us through these 6 days telling us what he did. And then throughout the Bible, we pick up additional creation accounts that help us understand what was really going on in God's discourse in the opening chapter. And so the assignment I gave you last week was to read Genesis 1 and read Job 38 and see if you can spot the parallels in Job 38 on Genesis chapter 1, and see if you can find stuff in Job 38 that will help you settle the fights you have with your Christian and non-Christian friends over the right interpretation of Genesis 1. There's some marvelous stuff in here that's really going to help us settle some of the church-splitting disputes that are going on about the interpretation of Genesis 1. And I say this because in my dialogues with people who take very different positions on is to try to lessen the hostility and bring peace and resolution and give us more insights as to what God is doing on creation. So I think all along we need to understand and appreciate, no matter how much we learn, how much we study these creation accounts in the Bible, we're never going to figure it all out. One of the reasons why I think we can be convinced we won't figure it all out, we don't know everything that God's going to do in the new creation. He's told us a little bit of what's going to happen in new creation, and therefore there may be purposes in creation that would be fulfilled in the new creation that we've received no information on. And so when you run into things in the created realm that you say, you know, this doesn't look fair, I don't understand it, why did God make mosquitoes, or you know, pick anything else, why did God use earthquakes? There seems to be a lot in the created realm that doesn't make sense, seems unfair. Why do we have to die so young? Why did Job have to go through all this suffering? Why do we have to go through all this suffering? There's a lot more going on in terms of the purposes of God and creation than has been revealed in this book. A lot's been revealed. We can figure a lot out, and I think we can figure enough out that we can certainly be more peaceable as we dialogue with one another on creation. So that's kind of the theme here. Okay, we got about 19 minutes left. What I'm going to do is do a quick read for you through Genesis chapter 1, and then I want all of you in the class here to work your way through Job 38 and tell me the commentary you see in Job 38 that helps us understand in greater detail what's going on in Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above it. And it was so. God called the expanse sky, and there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear. And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. God saw that it was good, then God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants, and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to the various kinds. And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night. Let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years. Let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars, and God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea, and every living thing and moving thing with which the water teems, according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number, and fill the water in the seas. And let the birds increase on the earth. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea, and the birds of the air, and every living creature that moves on the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth, and all the birds of the air, and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. God saw all that he made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. I just read to you probably the most contentious chapter in the entire Bible, in the context of 21st century Christianity and the context of the creation evolution debate. Okay, Job 38. I'm not going to read the text for you, but I'm going to ask you to examine it and see if you can pick out verses and paragraphs here in Job 38 that give us some commentary on what's happening in Genesis chapter 1. Just like Psalm 104 takes us through the six creation days, so does this. Yes. It does, and it also tells us that this is something that reveals marvelous intricacy and complexity. Evidently, the angels themselves are very impressed with how God set up this planet. And so, I mean, if you've been looking at our website, we now list 323 characteristics of the planet Earth that must be fine-tuned to make life possible on the planet. So just the physics and the geology of the Earth has to be exquisitely fine-tuned to make this a possible home. And you know what amazes me here is here's all these angels watching and saying, this is really fantastic. This is incredible. Mm-hmm. And this should also give us some pause. I think it's in here in the text. In the context of this debate amongst these five men, God is basically telling the five men, my angels can't figure all this out. What makes you think you can figure it all out? Mm-hmm. So here are these angels watching the laying the foundations of the earth, which is basically what's going on in Genesis 1:1 up to about 1:3. So just taking the very first part of Genesis 1, God says, this is the easy part. And this easy part, my angels can't figure it all out. What makes you think you've got it all figured out? Or in the context of modern cosmology, what cosmologists can claim to have it all figured out with God did in creation? Yes. It does. In fact, what I'm not going to get to it today, but verse 8 and following, we've got a set of verses here that will help us settle the debate about the Genesis flood. Many of you are aware there are Christians that are split in this. Some Christians who believe that the flood was global, covered the whole planet, wiped out all land-dwelling, air-breathing animals on it, and other Christians that say, no, the flood was universal. It wiped out humanity, except for those on board the ark, but the flood did not encompass the entire planet. I'd like to suggest that this passage here, along with some verses in Psalm 104 and Proverbs chapter 8, will help settle that debate. I don't think you can settle it just by looking at Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9. But if you go to these three additional creation accounts, I believe you can definitively settle which of those two interpretations of the flood is correct. And so we'll be going through it. You know, it talks about the doors of the sea, and clearly it's reflecting on what God was doing on the second creation day. You know, probably the third creation day, when God allows the great land masses to appear. Okay, that's very good. Anything else? I saw a hand somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say that Moses wrote all of this, and I don't know if he wrote
this. There's debate over who wrote this. Where there's a consensus is that, you know, the Bible commentaries do argue that this is one of the earliest written books in the entire Bible. And Job. And there's a debate over whether Job predates the Mosaic books or the Mosaic books predate Job. Most scholars believe that they're about contemporary. And the reason for that is that archaeological evidence now establishes that Hebrew writing really didn't come about until the 15th century B.C. Well, regardless, the text here is written in Hebrew. There's only one Aramaic passage in the Old Testament. That's Daniel.
That's not even my question. The question is what Jesus said, that everyone, beneath the good shepherds, that all before him were thieves and robbers, or thieves and liars, depending on the conversion. And then the chief knows his voice. So how I interpret that is he's talking about Moses and
well, to answer your question, there are some that speculate that maybe Elihu was the author, for the simple reason that he was quiet enough throughout those first 3 weeks that he would have had time to take notes. Sure. Well, you know, another possible interpretation is that maybe there was a sixth person there taking notes. Some have speculated that maybe the wives were there, not saying a word, but taking extensive notes. And it's a. But, you know, it could have been someone else, but I think the consensus is that Job is one of the oldest books in the Bible, either at the time of Moses or maybe slightly before. Yeah. Yes. So, yeah, we have a big fight over the Christian community about the evening morning passages that's dealt with here. So we can spend some time on that. You had a comment, Marlene?
In verse 9, it talks about the clouds for the garment and pitch darkness. Kind of squabbling men. As you explained, the pitch dark clouds and then
right. Yeah, an interpretation I put out in my books is that you know, God did not create the light de novo on creation day one. Rather, he transformed the dark clouds that encompass the earth so that they'd be translucent and let the light through, and then eventually the stars became visible where the atmosphere became transparent. This is one of my favorite passages to go to try to establish that really is the appropriate interpretation of Genesis 1. So thank you for finding that. We'll take some time trying to make that work. It also tells us a little bit here about the purposes of God transforming the atmosphere. You know, as you go into Genesis chapter 1, there's a debate. You know, when it talks about the stars serving as signs, what does all that mean? I'd like to suggest that Job 38 will help us to establish what Genesis 1 is saying when he says the sun, moon, and stars will serve as a sign. Okay, anyone else? And by the way, what Marlene picked up on here I think is really critical. The creation accounts that you see in Proverbs 8, Psalm 104, and here in Job 38, in reflecting on Genesis chapter 1, these are poetic passages as opposed to the narrative that you see in Genesis chapter 1. And the way Hebrew poetry works, it doesn't always follow a strict chronology. And I would argue that in Psalm 104, you have commentary on all six creation days. But it's not in the same strict order as you see in Genesis 1. And likewise, we notice here that this reference to the darkness and the atmosphere being like a garment that covers the waters is out of sequence. Don't let that bother you. That's just the way poetic Hebrew works. Don't expect it to follow the chronology. It's kind of what we discovered in Job 37, when Elihu makes reference to the expanse of the sky and refers to this image about it being a mirror hard as bronze. He doesn't explain it right afterwards. You've got to dig down a few verses before you get the explanation. And that, again, is a reflection of how Hebrew poetry is structured. So, yeah, we're not going to be able to finish all of this, but as you go through Job 38, keep in mind that it's not going to follow the strict chronological pattern you see in Genesis 1. Expect the text to jump around, and that will help you find more of the reflections on Genesis 1 in the text. Yes, Wes?
The thing that strikes me is to realize that before the creation, God thought through all the laws of physics and the design of the universe, of all the crafting the laws that cause this interaction. All of this was designed in his mind before he brought this into existence. And this is the marvel of that, the depth of that kind of reason and interaction. So he could pick a few things in his mind and he would miss this, that, and the other, you know.
Well, that's a great insight, Wes, because Genesis 1 doesn't say a word about the laws of physics. Job 38 does. And it makes the point that this is critical to understanding what God has done in creation. So yeah, this is the first place in the creation accounts that specifically addresses what God has done with the laws of physics. And basically what he is saying to these five gentlemen, you can't even figure out the laws of physics, and yet you think you've got the whole creation story all laid out. So the easy part is the laws of physics. You know, kind of picking up on Stephen Hawking said, you know, the secret to gaining the mind of God is to come up with the equations that will give you the physical theory of everything. And I would agree with Stephen Hawking, that's the easy step. But I would disagree with Stephen Hawking that we're ever going to pull it off. We'll never get a theory of everything. Well, we also told us that there are certain things that God will not share with us. And by the way, I believe it applies to the new creation. We'll never become omniscient or omnipresent. God is going to retain certain things for himself. Now, I'm just saying that God has placed limitations upon his creatures, both humans and angels, so that although we will gain more and more knowledge, and I believe in the new creation we're going to get a whole lot more knowledge than we have now, it will never be complete. Okay, we can know everything of some subject, but we're not going to know everything about everything. And that's what Stephen Hawking means by it, about a theory of everything. So, well, we'll talk about why that's impossible. Just the fact that we are confined dimensionally means that it will be impossible. And we'll also be confined dimensionally when we're in the new creation. Not as confined as we are right now, but there will be forever limits on our knowledge. On the other hand, there will never be limits on our capacity to learn more. You'll always have the capacity to learn more and more. So yeah, heaven's going to be a fun place. We're going to be able to learn at a faster rate, and it's going to be really exciting. And actually, as you read this book of Job, you can tell these five men are enjoying their company and enjoying their discussion. and they enjoy the fact that they are making progress and learning what God has done and figuring out his creation. And basically God is saying in chapter 38 and following, this is just the beginning. You men are going to learn a whole lot more than you know right now. And it's going to get more exciting, it's going to get more fun, it's going to be more enjoyable. And I think that's true to us in the 21st century. You know, we're in a much stronger position than these five men were in terms of understanding creation. But we also realize that the pace of discovery is marching at such a rate that we recognize as much as we know, we've only touched the... I got the wrong metaphor. I'm not good at metaphors. But we've only got a very tiny piece of the whole puzzle. The tip of the iceberg is all we're seeing. There's a lot more to be discovered. In fact, the scientists I admire the most are those people that are extremely knowledgeable, but knowledgeable enough to realize just how little they know and how much more there is to discover. But that also means there's going to be a lot more fun as we learn more and more. So knowledge is good, and getting more knowledge is great. But it's never going to end. We'll be in the new creation for all of eternity, and we're always going to be learning more and more about God. And one of the ways God really drums that home here says this is also true of the angels. They're intensely curious, much more powerful than we are, and they're only picking up the tip of the iceberg. So it says, consider that. Okay, let's bow for prayer. And again, I want you to spend some time between now and next week going through Job 38. And by the way, as we move on into Job 39, you'll see a lot more. Job 39 kind of gets you into creation days 5 and 6. Job 38 is particularly heavy on the content of the first four creation days. So I don't want you to get the idea that it's all in one chapter. It's not. This discourse from God goes on for five chapters. So he's just getting started in Job 38. And certainly he's responding to the debate, but he's also teaching us a lot about creation, the process. Father in heaven, we thank you for this marvelous book of Job, because it reflects debates that we have every day with our friends and our neighbors and our relatives. And Lord, I pray that you would give us some insights in how we can be more effective and presenting the evidences for your character, your existence, and your plan of salvation, thanks to this book. And also, Lord, we thank you for how we're encouraged in this book to look through your record, not only in the Bible, but in the natural realm, for evidence that we can exploit to persuade people that they need to give their lives to you. And Lord, I pray too, this would have great benefit in the sanctification process as we read and study this, that we'll be able to gain the kind of humility that Job and Elihu manifested. And Lord, that we would gain the mindset and the character, the demeanor before you, that will enable us to learn at a much more rapid rate. I pray too, Father, as we study this text, this creation text, you will enable us to be more effective at making for peace within the Christian community. Lord, we long for the day when Christians will not be afraid to talk about creation and evolution, but would welcome it and would see it as a means by which they can become a better ambassador for Christ. In Jesus' name, amen.